A quick show note. This episode was recorded before COVID-19. So much has changed from an academic standpoint in regard to the necessity for online classes, Zoom meetings, etc. I hope to do a follow-up episode discussing COVID's effect on Nichols. In the meantime, our conversation about academics at Nichols during this episode remains relevant. Hello, and thanks for tuning in to this Nichols College Alumni Experience podcast episode. Today's guest is Nichols Professor Maury Pelto, who serves as Dean of Academic Affairs and a Professor of Environmental Science. In addition, Maury has been the Director of the North Cascade Glacier Climate Project since 1983 and serves as the U.S. Representative of the World Glacier Monitoring Service. Maury is no spring chicken to Nichols, having worked here for 30 years, and is a pretty important part of Nichols' success as an institution, and if I may say so, a heck of a pickup basketball player. We'll start off by talking a bit about what Nichols is doing to maintain the value of your Nichols degree during these challenging times for higher education, and get into a lot of fascinating stuff regarding climate change and glaciers. Welcome, Dean Pelto.
Good to be here for this broadcast.
So before we get into climate change and glaciers and your life as a scientist, I thought maybe we could talk about a little bit about your time here at Nichols. So how did you, a scientist, end up teaching at Nichols College, a school which is predominantly well-known for its business program?
When I finished my doctorate program at the University of Maine, I had the chance to experience a big university, and I was looking for something a little bit smaller. And as you know, when you're just earned your degree and you're out looking for that first job, you can't be all that choosy. And so the first offer I got was Nichols College, and I didn't think about, oh, should I wait around and for a second offer? I learned that, you know, being in a business college does have its advantages. You know, as a scientist, it makes you think about efficiency. It makes you think beyond the science, you know, how to communicate it, how to execute it in a cost-effective way and not put yourself out of business.
So your current role at Nichols, what exactly does a dean of academic affairs do?
It might be easier to say what we don't do in some ways. But you know, the dean of academic, we schedule all the classes. You manage the faculty. You figure out what classes are offered, when they're offered. Student has a conflict, you know, they transferred in, what courses, you know, qualify. It really runs the gamut because you end up doing a lot of troubleshooting. You have to write curriculum. You have to figure out what is our new programs that might be useful for the college. What are the grant opportunities out there? And then you spend a ton of time with accreditation. And so accreditation is not only writing, but you have to do a lot of research before you can put together your accreditation report. And yes, it's internal research more than anything else, but nonetheless, you still have to really understand what's happening in every little corner of academics.
So you hit on something that was pretty interesting. You know, one of the questions I had is, you know, what is the process for adding or dropping a program, which I guess a lot of people would know as majors, but, you know, from our curriculum, what's the process like? I know that management information systems in the 90s, that's a major that you know, we had dropped, and the teacher certification program was one that we left the curriculum. On the other side, you know, obviously sport management in the early 2000s, you know, that was a big addition to Nichols and criminal justice. So what's kind of the process or the thought process for adding a program or dropping a program?
I'm sure it's changed through time, so I'll speak about what it looks like today. Mm-hmm. We have an admissions advisory council, so it's combined of people from admissions and from the academic side. So we look at, one, do we have the capacity to teach a program? 2, is there demand from the students out there? And 3, how well does it fit our mission? And if we can answer yes on all 3, then it's a pretty easy program to add. If, for example, we think, well, there's a lot of student demand and it fits our mission, but we have no expertise, to create a lab would cost us a lot of money, then maybe the answer is a hard one, a no for now. And so for the addition part of it, it's an easier process. But if we can figure out what we can add, we can do it pretty quick. And we're looking for some areas that don't take a tremendous amount of new investment, that we have the faculty in place, we have the software, kind of the infrastructure we need. And so, for example, we've spent the last 2 weeks looking at adding a concentration in the finance program, but it would be corporate finance and investments. And really, we identified that as potential, and it's taken us 2 weeks to figure out the curriculum. Christine Bowden is largely doing that. We'll submit it to the curriculum committee, and hopefully next fall that will roll out. So we can do it pretty fast. Once you've identified, yes, we can do this.
So what was the impetus for, deciding that's a field? Was it looking at industry gaps, or was it kind of feedback from alumni?
Well, we get feedback from alumni, but you also look at where our alumni are working, and we have a lot working specifically in the investments area. Mm-hmm. And you can major in finance and do that just fine, which those alumni have done. But maybe there's an avenue to have a little more investments in the curriculum, and maybe that also attracts a little different kind of student. So that's what we're looking at. In terms of eliminating a program, and the most recent one that was eliminated was the education program. Now, the state told us we had to. We did not have a sufficient enrollment for them to want to continue to license us. So that was taken out of our hands. If we look back to a previous one that was, we don't have any more legal studies, for example, there, we didn't have the demand for our students. And sometimes you have a chicken and egg question. Do we not have enough demand because we don't have the right curriculum and people and the right recruiting method? But at some point, you're down there at zero students, essentially. And how you ended up there doesn't matter so much. It's that you can't afford the investment.
Mm-hmm. I think Nichols has always, done a good job of kind of foreseeing the future as best you can, especially when it comes to, industries and adding programs. Obviously it's a tough time right now in higher education. There are a lot of private liberal arts schools closing. Just Hampshire College was just announced. Mount Ida, Newbury. I know Wheelock was just acquired, I guess you could say, by BU. Given the industry right now, do you foresee any changes in the current higher education system, which might, I know Nichols is a very high return on investment major, anything in business. So I know we're pretty safe from what I hear, but do you foresee any changes in the current higher education system, which, we should be aware of when we're planning that type of curriculum?
And when we look out there at the landscape of the colleges that have really struggled, there's two things that strike me about them. And one is most of them have not been, really striving for the highest level of, say, accreditation or achievement there. And so at Nichols, we are striving to not stay where we are, but to move forward and be a college that attracts even a higher level of student that has, better resources. And I think that's the mentality you need. I mean, it's a competitive landscape. And higher ed, in general, maybe through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, wasn't that competitive. So it was easy to get complacent and just, steer down the road, same old, same old. And so if you had that mentality, I think that's where you run into trouble. If you have a mentality that it is competitive and you have to go out every day and think about, what am I not doing that somebody else is doing to make their college attractive, effective for their graduates, then you're going to get left in the dust. And so I think, you know, we are doing that. You know, we're evaluating programs all the time. What should we add? How can we add value within those programs? So that's what I think you have to think about is value. You know, what can we add that increases the value of the education to our students and increases our value to them and perception?
So what types of things might Nichols alumni and parents of Nichols students be interested to hear about in regard to, you know, things that are going on in academic programs that are going to better prepare our students for success? I know you had mentioned finance, and we just received some really good information about our Bloomberg terminals, which were added, and you know, what types of things like that are going on that alumni would be like, yes, they're really kind of hitting it out of the park.
If you look at the higher education landscape, you'll see a lot of similar words coming out of colleges, and they're good words. They're things you have to do. Leadership is emphasized, and Nichols does that. Experiential learning is another word that's being emphasized. Cross-disciplinary. So you can't just focus on those because that's what everybody's doing. Everybody now has internship programs, et cetera. So what can we add that is a little different? And so I think when we put the Bloomberg terminals in this year, you know, the thought was other places have Bloomberg terminals, lots of other colleges. Mm-hmm. So how are we going to do it differently? And the one thing we could think of was greater access. And by access, if you look at other colleges, maybe their investment club or their finance majors or, you know, specific departments and specific students have access to them. But we put them in a regular classroom that almost every student, every business student will certainly have a class in.
Is it true that all of our students, liberal arts, business, whomever they have to be, or it's only business, are all of our business students, regardless of being a finance major, have to be trained in that Bloomberg?
Yes, so that in your financial accounting course, which a lot of people take freshman year, you know, some people push it off to the sophomore year. In that course, you have to get the Bloomberg Market Concept Certificate. And so that's where we'll get exposed to it. And beyond that, then, you'll get exposed to it in other classes. But right off the bat, then, if you're a finance or accounting major, you put in that course your very first semester here. So you'll emerge with a certificate in your first semester, and you'll have 3.5 years to leverage your interests in that area. And in that way, in a single semester, we can get 300 students exposed to the terminals, and other places that have had them for many more years don't reach that level of exposure for like the current students. So we're going to be in the top, you know, 10 to 20 universities in the country in terms of the percentage of our student body that actually gets to utilize Bloomberg terminals.
I did read that Professor Bowden had sent me an email about being an experiential learning partner at Bloomberg. And she had mentioned that out of the 950 institutions worldwide that offer Bloomberg terminals on campus, only 33 are ELP partners, and Nichols is one of those 33. So certainly that was something that kind of raised my ears a bit to this. I think it's really fantastic. She had also mentioned that out of the 950 institutions, we ranked 42 with certifications, which, you know, you think about Nichols College and the size of it, that's pretty darn impressive.
Yeah, and that's my point is that, yes, after one semester, we're at 42. After two semesters, we'll be in the top 20.
Wow.
And so that, if you think about that, that's just a good example. It's not the only example, but it's an example where we're trying to take a high-impact software, in this case, software-hardware combination that the Bloomberg Terminal is, and expose a lot of our students to it. Mm-hmm. And so being small, we can do that. You know, it could be in the fall, another example is, you know, we have a trip every year that goes down to New York City. And it's just a day trip, and it's not limited to one major. But typically, we'll have 100 students go down. So again, it's close to 10% of our campus goes down to New York City, spreads out depending on their major, and goes into the different businesses that they're interested in, meet with alumni there in New York City. Almost every group will meet with some alumni because we have alumni spread out through the businesses in New York City. So again, that's a high level of penetration. If you think of market penetration as a business person, I mean, we have a high penetration into our student body of these opportunities.
And I'll say, I actually was one of the chaperones on that trip. And there's a great YouTube video up or on the college's Vimeo channel of the trip, and you get to see a little behind the scenes stuff. And, you know, as you mentioned, bringing our students out and having them meet with alumni, like in a few weeks, we're going to meet with Bob Stansky at Fidelity and Rob DeRubis and a bunch of other Nichols grads out there. And then the students are going to have lunch with four people at different companies in Boston. I think networking the students in conjunction with this software, I mean, that's something that a small, nimble college like Nichols is able to offer our students where some of our larger competition can't. And I think that's when you get into the
networking opportunities that our students have that are different than the overall student. I'll just focus on the alumni piece, but you think about the different programs we have. We have the sophomore shout out where we bring in 40 alumni that are all have graduated within the last 6 years, and they talk with every sophomore, and you rotate around the tables and you have a chance to meet with these recent graduates. You have the 2 weeks after that, you have the career fair. And the career fair, yeah, represents a whole bunch of different corporations and organizations.
But it just 70 is what I heard.
Yeah, but we'll have 30 graduates there. And so again, even as a regular student, you're going out to network with recruiters in general, but a lot of those recruiters happen to be alums. We also have the board of advisors in the spring tends to have a round robin kind of quick interview program. And so you just think of those examples, and that ignores all the individual visits of student groups to New York City or to Boston. Just a lot of networking opportunities, and we really leverage the alumni to do that. And it's a great way for our students to see that people want to network with you. It's not like they're out there to try to get you, trick you, you know, give you a grade, maybe not a passing grade. No, they are anxious to talk with you.
And you know, I should mention too, any alumni who are listening to this podcast and want to participate in that, want to meet students, want to, you know, host students at their business, you know, definitely reach out to me. I'd be happy to help arrange that. And before we get into some of the interesting stuff on your work with glaciers, the last question I guess I'd ask you academically is, so you've had the opportunity over 30 years to see several decades of students come through Nichols. You know, I know there's a lot of studies and a lot of articles about the different generations and you know, what kind of makes them up. I hear from alumni sometimes about, you know, work ethic or being a self-starter and how, you know, things have kind of changed in terms of generationally. I see this generation as being someone, as you mentioned, who are fantastic at making connections. You know, they've grown up with social media, so that's kind of a natural thing for them. They're very good at solving problems. What is your assessment of the current generation of college students in that? How do they differ from the college students that you started teaching when you started here in the I guess it would be, what, the mid or late 80s?
Yeah, it's a different challenge. And it's partly because of the information they can access, and it's partly just because, you know, our society evolves, and even my generation, your generation has changed because of our access to information. So maybe you could say our attention span mm-hmm. is challenged. But what we see with students today, obviously, they don't have a lower potential. You just have to approach them a different way. You have to put a lot more effort into engaging them. You can't just tell them, you know, read this homework assignment. And if I did that in the 1980s, you know, the bulk of my class would read that homework assignment and do the work, just period. And the work they submitted may have been good, bad, or indifferent, but it was submitted on time without much begging or pleading. Today, if you do that, you're not going to get much back. And so you have to reach out. You have to find a way to engage them. And so you can't just, we didn't know any better. You know, a textbook is all we had. Mm-hmm. What else could we go find? Well, now, you know, you literally have the world at your fingertips in the way of knowledge and information. So you've got to make that information real in your classroom. If you don't make it real, then how can it compete? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the real challenge, is that the time it takes to find the real data sets that the students look at, and it's not something they can read about. It's not something that's dry. There is no textbook that has this information. The only place they can find it is in the current databases, or, you know, maybe it's the analysis of a current business, political, whatever the problem is. And so you have to just work harder to find those. And then just, you know, it just takes more, sometimes it's more hand-holding, definitely more hand-holding, more reminders. They're used to a higher level of support, you know, whether it's from their parents. And so you can't expect them to be where they're not.
And I'm always amazed at how, you know, when we do bring alumni back, say it's for the the networking events, and with the Board of Advisors, we do speed networking where they move after every 5 minutes of talking with alumni. I'm just always amazed at how impressed the alumni is that meets with them, in terms of just kind of, I don't want to say polish, but how natural they are in communicating and networking. And, you know, it's definitely a big change even than I've seen starting here in right around 2000, you know, but I think that's generally the way things go. They just change, and you, as you said, you kind of adapt to that. So I'm looking at the clock here, and I think probably we should switch gears a little bit and talk about your work with glaciers. So can you start off kind of briefly just talking a little bit about what is a glacier and why they're so important?
Yeah, glaciers are just permanent bodies of snow and ice that move. They move because of gravity. And so, you know, sea ice or lake ice around here, you know, may move, but it's not permanent. You know, it's going to melt next week. And so that's what differentiates a glacier. Now, glaciers cover a good portion of the Earth. Not the portions where we live, of course, so we can put them out of mind sometimes. But they also contain most of the fresh water on Earth as well. And so that makes them both a resource, but also can be a hazard. Because if that volume of water is shifted from a frozen reservoir into the ocean, sea level rises. If that frozen reservoir that sits on the mountain melts away and is no longer there, then it's no longer a resource for that stream, that lake, that community.
So I know that climate change is something of a hot button politically lately. I know that I had read that your research team monitors and records 47 glaciers, and that your research shows that all of them have retreated and four of them have actually disappeared. Is there a way to link this scientifically to global warming?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty simple story, really. And you can't necessarily look at any one glacier to do that. But what you can do is look around the world. And the World Glacier Monitoring Service that I work pretty carefully with, you know, they have observations from thousands of glaciers. And you can look at those thousands of glaciers. And each of them occupies a certain environment. And near that glacier, there's also a weather station. So you can contrast the temperature records, precipitation records, and what's happened to that glacier. And so it's pretty easy then to sort out that it's temperature that's driving the loss in glacier mass. And that's true in the Andes. It's true in the Himalaya. It's true in the Brooks Range of Alaska. It's true in the Alps of Europe. It's the same story everywhere you go.
Now, is this something that, in terms of like glacier recession and glacier, I guess you could call it disappearing, is that something that can be fixed or at the very least stopped?
The glaciers are huge. still. I mean, people ask me all the time, are they all going to be gone? Well, yeah, I've watched an order of them disappear. But what people may not realize is, you know, our biggest glaciers are the size of states.
Wow.
And these are, you know, generally in Antarctica or Greenland, but even the big ones in Alaska are as big as the state of Rhode Island. So we're talking about huge masses, and the largest glacier I've worked on in Alaska is, you know, at its thickest location is over 4,000 feet thick. So you're not going to melt 4,000 feet of ice very quickly in a mountain area where it's not all that warm, even with global warming. So they're going to endure for a while, but they also have no protection. They're sitting out there. They can't put on sunscreen, can't put on a coat, can't turn on the air conditioning. So they're stuck with the weather. We reduce the amount of fossil fuels we're putting in the atmosphere that also retain outgoing long-wave radiation and warm up our planet. No, that's the solution for them. It has to be a change in our energy portfolio.
So if you know, everything going on with companies like Tesla and the like, if that comes to fruition, and let's say that you know, gasoline as a automobile source you know, is eliminated in 15 years, I mean, is that something that would make a significant enough change that we would be able to reverse or stop what's going on now? I mean, is there any way to predict that, or is it...
It's not so much reverse as you could slow the process. You could also stop, you know, kind of the continuation of the process. It's not going to happen overnight. And in some situations, it would be too late. You know, once a system has entered a process of disintegration, you know, you can't stop it. Now, the disintegration may take a couple centuries to play out. But once you've crossed that threshold, it's not going to stop. And so there's not one answer. It will vary from mountain range, from glacier to glacier, from ice sheet to ice sheet, you know, what that answer is. But the ice sheets haven't always been there. So we know in periods of time in the past when it was warmer, just because the solar forcing was different, the oceans were in a different arrangement, et cetera, the different amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than there is now because of those things, that... ice sheets were either smaller or non-existent. So we know that that will happen with a warmer climate.
Now, when you go and you measure these glaciers, so you do that over the summer when you're not teaching?
Yeah, when I physically am standing on the glaciers, it's generally in the summer. I've gone to the same field area for 35 consecutive years. I'm always there in the first couple weeks in August.
And that's Washington State?
It's in the state of Washington. I do quite a bit of work on glaciers in Alaska and work with colleagues on glaciers around the world. I do a lot of kind of cooperative research with the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center and make observations that take real advantage of the instruments they use. And so it's quiet now because the government shut down, but typically every couple of weeks I'll get a question from them about a specific glacier. What have I observed? And or they've seen something, they ask me for feedback on that.
What's it, when you head out and you actually spend time on the glacier, like what's an average day like? What do you scientists do out there?
Well, I don't think my field team is like the average scientist because we work in wilderness areas in the United States. Wilderness areas don't allow motorized vehicles, even a chainsaw. So we have to backpack in everything, which means we can't take heavy equipment. We can't take mechanized equipment. We don't have drills. We don't have a helicopter support. So as a result, we don't look that impressive, you know. You know, we're intense. You know, you get up in the morning right after the sun comes up, and, you know, we turn on the camp stove. We have oatmeal for breakfast. Quick cup of coffee or tea, if you like that. And then we're off to the glacier. It doesn't matter really what the weather is. It can be a nice sunny day or cold and rainy. either way, you know, you're heading up to the glacier. And then we'll just do our measurements. You know, we'll look at, we'll map the glacier. We'll measure how deep the snowpack is across the glacier. We'll measure the rate of melt. Depending on the glacier, we might have a gauge below it to measure the runoff coming off of it. We'll measure where the terminus position is. And we'll do all that in one day. And the next day, we'll do a different glacier.
So there's no bonfires in Bud Light. Pretty much it's oatmeal and science.
Yeah, I mean, all right, maybe if I was stronger, I could carry a beer up there. But the reality is I have done that in the past, but I have to admit that that's not one of those things that has stood the test of time. Mm-hmm. You know, there's other things that were of greater use, but also of greater comfort than maybe if they had freeze-dried beer, you know. And so for dinner, same thing, you know, we'll have, you know, we have a variety of foods, but they're all going to be really light, you know, rice, couscous. You know, you can, there's lots of nice light sauces you can mix in them, and dried fruit. So you can understand it. If it's got to be light.
So you're there for how long? How many days?
So we're there for just about 3 weeks, and we're in a tent in the alpine areas every night. We do shift locations, but when we do, we will backpack out from one glacier, typically 3 to 4 hour backpack. Get in the car, drive to the next trailhead, hike back in that same day. And so I like to think of it, this is also the time of year of, you know, the training camps for the NFL. So I think we have 2 days, is how I think of it.
Man, it sounds like a lot of work, but it sounds like fun. I mean, do you obviously make pretty good relationships with folks there, and I'd imagine you probably have to present at a lot of conferences. And do you do any work with the National Geographic Society? Or
I don't do any work with the National Geographic Society. Isn't a real big science organization, so you know, obviously I do some work with NASA, and so that's a much bigger science. The American Geophysical Union is the biggest physical sciences organization in the world, and I write a blog for them. So twice a week, I have to write an article about a glacier. And so I do a lot of work for them. And it was fun at the American Geophysical Union meeting this year. It was the 100th anniversary of the American Geophysical Union. So they wanted to look back at the century of science. And so they picked 5 people who look at the cryosphere, so all ice science, so snowpack, sea ice, permafrost, glaciers, ice sheets were the 5. And so they picked me to talk about glaciers and the science over the last century. And so that was, you know, both an honor and just a really fun experience.
Hmm. Well, when we get off mic here, we're going to talk to Professor Harmon and see if we can't maybe go somewhere with this freeze-dried beer idea that you've come up with. I think it has some merit. But I'm looking at the clock here, so I'm thinking the last question that I have for you is, if you could be remembered for one thing at Nichols after you kind of retire, head off into the sunset, what would you like that thing to be?
That I helped push people to know more, learn more, experience more, and just excel.
And you know, certainly I've heard your name come up often when I meet with students and even former alumni. I know I've brought alumni to campus and you know, they've recognized you. Alumni have graduated in the 90s. Say, oh my God, is that Professor Pelto? You know, so certainly you've definitely made an impact on this institution, and we thank you. And I thank you for spending some time with us today.
I look forward to listening to these and what Professor Harmon comes up with his freeze-dried beer. It better be fast.
Yeah. I thank Professor Pelto for joining us today and being a part of our Nichols College alumni experience. I hope you'll join us for another episode soon. Certainly, Nichols has touched a lot of people over the years, and as the buildings change or modernize, the things that stay the same are the stories of the people who help make the college what it is. Those are the stories I hope to bring to you through these podcasts, so until the next time, thank you, and go Bison!
Welcome to the den. Welcome to the pen. The herd taking the court. We going for a win. We going for it all. We'll do it till we fall. So throw it up, kick it off. We was born ready to ball. We've been practicing all summer. Up all night.